the master takes a portion of what the slaves have produced and returns it to them. Because he wants them to be able to work the next day. He has to feed them, he has to take care of them. And not just enough that they get by biologically, but that they don't revolt, don't kill him, and all the rest of it. So the master, who gets the whole product of the slave's work, returns a portion of it to the slave, to reproduce the slave. But the rest of it, the surplus, the part of what the slave produced as an excess to what the slave gets back, is not the slave's. It belongs instantaneously, indeed the whole product does, to the master. And it's the master who distributes it. So notice, in the slave structure, the people who do the work and produce the surplus don't get it and don't distribute it. Other people do. That's an exploitative class structure for Marx and in Marx's system. So that's the third one. Now the fourth one. Feudalism. Feudalism. By the way, don't associate these words with particular parts of the world or particular periods of time, even though those names are taken from that. Feudalism comes from medieval Europe. These are types of class structure, and as I'm going to show you, they exist everywhere, always. All that really matters is the combinations of them, the proportion in any country of the one versus the other. As I told you, when we're done, I'm going to show you the United States has them all five of them. What's the feudal one? In the feudal one, we have a group, again, of people who do the work. They're not slaves. They're not the property of somebody else. That's what distinguishes this exploitative system from slavery. The serf, using the tradition of European serfdom and feudalism, is tied to the land. Literally, where you grow up, the land being farmed by your mother and father is where you stay. Their lord, I'm going to tell you in a minute what a lord is your lord because you're born into this arrangement. You're nobody's property, you're not a slave, you're a serf, and the serf is tied to the land. And here's how it works, to give you an example, in European feudalism. 3 days of every week, you work on the land allocated to you and your family. You raise animals, you grow crops, and you keep, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you work on your own piece of land. By the way, it's not your piece because there wasn't, in European feudalism, no private property in land. Let me do that again. They didn't allow private property. One more time. No private property in land. So the land was assigned to you. The Lord assigned it to you, but in the ideology of feudalism, God assigned it to you. Because to think of private property was denounced in medieval Europe as a sin against Jesus Christ and an arrogance of the human community that was intolerable to the Lord, the one up in the sky. Why? Because human beings didn't put that land there. God put us there on the land. And the idea that the man or woman said, "This is mine," is an arrogance against the Lord. It is taking unto yourself power that doesn't belong to you, and that is an affront to the way the world really works. And to say I have rights of power is a blasphemy, for which in the Middle Ages they would cook you, literally. Okay? So in feudalism, people are assigned to the land. And for 3 days of the week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, the serf works on the piece of land assigned to him or her. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, the same serfs leave that land and they go to the domain of the Lord, the big shot in the area, who has a big piece of land, and they work on that. And now watch. The fruits of their labor for Thursday, Friday, Saturday, on the land assigned to the Lord, he gets. On Sunday, as you know, we rest. We go to church in the morning, and we eat too much in the afternoon, and we sleep it off in the evening. And then we resume the week. Notice, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, the serfs are producing an output that they themselves keep and consume. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, the serfs are working to produce an output that is not theirs and that they do not distribute. The lord of the manor, the feudal lord, takes that output, the surplus, and he gets it and he distributes it. So now we've accounted for four: communist, ancient, slave, and feudal. The last one. Capitalist. It is also exploitative because, as I will show you, There's a group of people who produce a surplus, but they're not the people who get it and distribute it. Somebody else does. And this, by the way, Marx is not a detailed analyst of communism, never wrote about that in any kind of detail, ever. Nor did he ever write about socialism. These are not topics that occupied his attention. Engels once wrote a famous pamphlet, and even that was a kind of political pamphlet more than anything else, but it's an interesting one if you're ever interested. It's the only time you have a sustained discussion of socialism and communism. It's a pamphlet called Socialism, Utopian and Scientific. But it's more an ideological and polemic than it is an analytic. Marx analyzed capitalism. That's the only system he really went through. Why? He didn't believe in prediction. He thought that was a silly activity. Nobody can predict. He didn't know what's going to happen in the future. Nobody else does either. What he could analyze was how capitalism worked and draw some conclusions about that, which might be applicable to other societies, but beyond that, he didn't go. So we do really have the benefit of Marx on capitalism in a way we do not have him on anything else. So how does capitalism work, he says. And again, I'm now going to use a modern American idiom to get it across because it's easier than trying to take you through Marx's language. But it's all in Volume 1 of Capital, very neatly pointed out. If you ever have a chance, read it. It's a beautifully written book, by the way, full of irony and humor and passion, as well as economic argument. Those of you who've taken courses in economics, which I've spent my life teaching, I can assure you that this is much more fun and much better written and much more interesting than 99% of what passes for the literature of economics, my own included. Okay, so I'm going to use the American idiom. It works like this, Marx's argument. You're looking for a job. You go to talk to your employer, and you and the employer sit down to discuss your work that you hope to get. And the employer explains to you, this is what we make here, in this factory, this office, this workshop. And if you come to work here, he explains to you, you come at 8 o'clock and you stay till 5 and you have an hour off for lunch or whatever the details are. And then after the nice pleasantries and you make the right questions and make the right body movements to show how interested you are in this job, and the employer does the same in reverse to you, then you get to that hairy point about the money. And the question is, how much are you going to get paid? At that point, the conversation works something like this, Marx would say, if he were using the modern idiom. Let's suppose the employer proposes, and let's suppose, to make this quick, you accept $20 an hour. Okay, you agree. You're going to come 8 o'clock, Monday to Friday, stay till 5, each of those 5 days, and you're going to be paid $20 for every hour that you put in effort. And you understand when you come, that morning at 8 o'clock each day, the employer will tell you where to go, what tools to use, what raw material to work on, what system of work to use, and you will apply, hopefully honestly and earnestly, you will apply your brains, your muscles, whatever you've learned, to do the job you're asked to do. And at the end of the day at 5 o'clock, you go home. You leave behind what you produced. Let me do that again. You've poured your creativity and your labor into something. You've produced something. It's really an extension of you. And at the end of your work, you go home and you leave it behind. If you take it with you, people in dark blue uniforms come and beat you up because you have stolen what is not yours. It isn't mine. I made it. Not the way the system works. You made it. Here we go now. You don't get it. Now Marx's argument comes. There's only one reason on earth that the employer would ever pay you $20 for every hour of your effort. And that only one reason is the following. During that hour, your labor, your effort, adds to what the employer has to sell more than $20 worth of stuff. Because if all your labor in that hour did was add to, let's suppose this place makes, I don't know, ballpoint pens. If all your hour worth of work did was add an extra $20 worth of pens, which then the employer, who gets to keep it when the day is over, he then goes and sells it. That's what employers do in a modern capitalist system. If what he got for the extra pens your labor produced was $20, which he then had to turn over to you to pay you for the $20 an hour, there'd be nothing in it for him. Worse than that. Because you use up raw materials, you use up equipment, you have to have the light on when you work, so someone has to pay the electricity. He wouldn't even be able to pay his costs. He needs you, here we go now, he needs you to produce more every hour than you get paid. Because if you don't, he'll never hire you. So the condition of employment in a capitalist system is necessarily that every worker produces a surplus that he doesn't get. The surplus is taken and distributed by somebody else. So, for example, let's say you produce an extra $30 worth of pens in your hour. Good, the employer takes the $30 worth of pens, the extra produced by your hour of work. He sells them for $30, he gives the 20 to you, that's your wage, your salary, and he keeps the other 10. And what happens with the other 10? You might think, you'd be wrong by the way, you might think, well, he uses it to pay the electric bill and to buy more raw material. He might, but in a capitalist system, that's his choice. He could take the $10 and go to the Bahamas and you'll never see him again. And the next day when you arrive to work, it'll be locked. And you'll be screwed. Because you do not participate in receiving or distributing that surplus. Somebody else does. And in that way, capitalism isn't different from feudalism or slavery. They are all equally or equivalently exploitative system. Obviously, they're different from one another. A worker in capitalist is not a slave, just like a serf is neither a slave nor a free laborer who contracts with an employer to work. There are differences in this system. But punchline, folks, if you concentrate on the differences, if your way of thinking is all about power, and you're very excited, the slave has no power, doesn't even have power over himself, his own body and life. And here we go now. You have a revolution to overcome slavery, to make everybody free, and you focus on that's a transit. You may miss that exploitation still exists. It's just changed its form. Marx enjoyed using the phrase wage slaves. Why? Hint. He wanted to suggest that there was something that wage earners and slaves had in common. And what they had, Volume 1 of Capital explains. They are exploited. Suppose you raise the wages of a worker. In my example, instead of getting $20 an hour when each hour of your labor gives $30 worth of extra pens to your employer, suppose you have a struggle and a strike with your union and you drive up your wages and you're now going to get $24 an hour, not 20. That's a 20% increase. Hey, you could feel powerful. Very few unions get 20% increases in their wages. Is that a good thing? Yes, from a radical point of view. Does it help the workers? Absolutely. Does it stick it to the employer? You got it. Does it end exploitation? Not at all. It just changes the dimensions. Is the worker still exploited? Absolutely. Absolutely. And suppose it were the case, just for a minute with me, suppose it were the case that exploitation hurts people, eats into their souls, upsets their equilibrium emotionally, psychologically, then getting a rising wage, which you might have thought was your point and purpose in goal and struggle in life, might leave you as unhappy and as irritated by the fact, what fact? that you're always delivering to your employer more than he pays you. That vague sense that so many workers have in capitalism, that every day is an experience of getting ripped off. That attitude that makes you snatch the ballpoint pen off the desk and stick it somewhere in your body so you can take it home. That makes you take that extra roll of toilet paper in the bathroom to save yourself having to buy it. And some of you are smiling. You know what I mean. Do you ever wonder where that instinct comes from? Even those of you that don't do it because your mother and father told you it's not good to steal, you worry that you might be being stupid by not doing that. And why is that? Because being exploited is something that probably bothers you. How many Americans need to say to each other and to themselves, I'm never going to take a job unless I get paid what I'm worth? Marxism tells you that kind of job is not available, you schmuck. It's not there. You're dreaming, and you're either going to have to face that you're never going to get what you're worth, or you're going to have to live in a fantasy that you are. And a fantasy is a fantasy. It's not a substitute for reality. It coexists with reality, and the coexistence is not peaceful. So Marx's argument is human beings organize something they can't do without. We have to produce. We can't live unless we produce food, clothing, shelter, and a lot of other things. So production is not an option. All communities have production. It's one of the major things they do, usually the most major one. Survival depends on it. And if you produce, you're going to organize the surplus somehow. So every society has an organization of surplus. And they all have one or another or combinations of these five. And so the first interesting thing a Marxist class analysis says is, wow, think of all the societies, including our own today, that have an organization of the surplus, but never discuss it, never argue about it, never question it. Wow. You don't have to be an advanced student of psychology to worry that if there's something fundamental to your life that you can't think or talk about, you got a problem. Right? Those experiences, for example, that we have as children, in difficulties we have with our siblings, with our parents, to borrow from Freud, particularly our earliest, how shall I use the words, explorations in our sexuality, have, because of our culture, all kinds of troubling effects on us. Now, as you become an adult, these things work their way through you. Your relationships, or lack thereof, your interactions with other people, and so on. Now, you have two ways to go. You can either ask and explore how these things shape your life, or you can pretend that they don't. They'll shape your life in either way. But generally, the presumption is better off if you think about it and try to work on it. And some of us pay huge amounts of money to professionals to help us to do that. And other of us don't and pretend it's all comedic operations, things to make fun of. Great thinkers have said something I'm going to borrow from now. What Freud did to make individuals begin to recognize that there are parts of their lives that are shaping them, past and present lives, and they would be better off thinking about them and making sense of them than pretending they're not there, Marx is the same thing at the level of society. Societies would be better off if they came to terms with, recognized, thought about, and discussed with one another the parts of their culture and society that are shaping them, but that they have been too afraid, too repressed to deal with. Class analysis is, for Marx, that. He wants to get a return of the repressed, to overcome the repression of this reality of surplus organization that every society has. We will be better off if we face it and deal with it than if we pretend it isn't there. Or to be more pointed, we'll be much more successful in building a world of liberty, equality, and fraternity if we figure out how we have to change the class structure, the organization of surplus. And notice, to talk about the organization of surplus and changing it is different from talking about power, property, and consciousness. Okay? Before I go on, I promised you, and I'm going to do it now, how the United States has all of them, all five of them. So let's go through it quickly. I'm not going to bother explaining to you how it has capitalism, because you all know that. Many of you work in a capitalist enterprise. They're all around us, employer, employee. You know that, so I don't have to. But now the ancient, well, you kind of know that too, right? The ancient is the self-employed person, works on his or her own, produces enough to sustain themselves, but produces more as well, and they distribute. Let's take the individual dentist. He or she has an office, and they go in there, and they torture you with root canals and all the other things that they do. And do they do that enough to sustain themselves, their income? Yes. Do they stop there? Never. Why? Because they have lots of other expenses to take care of beyond themselves. They have to pay the electricity that keeps the lights on, that works those drills that hurt. They have to buy all that equipment. They have to pay the receptionist. They have to pay taxes. They have to pay for the security services. They have lots of expenses. They have to do a surplus. Ask any dentist. They wish they could go home at the end of those hours in the day that they have worked to earn enough money to live at whatever standard of living they can't. So, of course, they produce a surplus, but they get it. And indeed, one of the great charms of being a dentist or an architect or a doctor or any of these other kinds of workers, if you ask them, is, to use the American idiom, I'm my own boss. I am my own boss. I make my own decisions. They love that. We have a culture that venerates that class structure, the self-employed. I do an experiment. I teach at the University of Massachusetts often, and I often teach large classes of 300 students. And I circulate a little piece of paper. Each student gets a piece of paper, and I often ask them, write down for me, among other things, you know, what your major is and where you come from and so forth. What do you hope to be doing 5 years after you graduate? Because I've always learned, I learn a lot about these students to know what they think, what they hope. 2/3 of them write down, I want to be my own boss. It is a beautiful commentary on the ideology that has picked out one class structure as the desirable one. Two things are true. First, the overwhelming majority of them cannot do that because there are no such jobs. The number of them that will ever be self-employed is tiny. They must know that somewhere, since the communities they all come from, it's very obvious all the time, including their own parents. And the second thing is, those people who are self-employed are working their asses off most of the time. What kind of desideratum is that? The image and the reality, which they know are askew, but it's such a powerful image and a draw that they imagine it. Anyway, we have lots of self-employed people. So we have a capitalist class structure, and we have an ancient class structure. But now let me tantalize you, because some of this we're going to go into in the next classes. Do we have slavery? Of course we do. Do we have places where slaves produce a surplus that they don't get, where the slave master gets the fruit of their labor and then gives them back some of it to sustain them, because he needs them to keep going, but he keeps the surplus? Sure. Let me give you just a few examples. We have professional baseball. In professional baseball, teams, ready, sell people to one another. Let's do that again. Many of you have never thought about this because they're paid a lot of money. That's cute. They're paid a lot of money. It has nothing to do with whether you're a slave or not. Are you the property of somebody who can sell you? Yes. Yes. Can you decide to do that? No. The only way you can escape the slavery of baseball is to leave baseball. That you can do. That's interesting. So it's a kind of a partial slavery. That means you're a slave in this realm, but you're not a slave in that realm. Here's another example. A little harder to document because it's illegal. Prostitution. All over the United States, there are prostitutes. Prostitutes often have, male and female, prostitutes often have pimps. The relationship between the prostitute and the pimp, and there are many studies that often, not always, but often involve slavery. The pimp literally buys and sells to other pimps his stable of prostitutes. They work, they earn the money from what they do, and all of that goes to the pimp, who then gives them the sustenance that they need to keep going, keeping the difference, which is what he's in it for. Okay? So, of course it exists. There are religious communities all over the United States who have something dangerously close to slavery, but they use the privacy, the way prostitution uses its illegality, to hide all of it. But do we have it? You betcha we have it. You betcha. Feudalism. Do we have a situation where one person produces surplus? Part of the time they work, they keep the fruits for themselves, and part of the time it goes to the Lord. Sure we do. All over the place. The biggest place in the United States where feudalism occurs, in the Marxist sense, is in the traditional American household, at home. What's the traditional household? The wife, the adult woman, works. She doesn't work 3 days a week for herself and 3 days a week for somebody else. Here's how it does. She gets up in the morning and she makes breakfast, labor. She transforms raw food into cooked food. Does she do it just to sustain herself? No. She makes eggs and toast and coffee for herself. And another place setting with eggs and toast and coffee for dear hubby. And when she makes the bed, just her side? Nah, she makes the whole bed. And when she cleans underwear, it's just hers? No, his too. Wow. She does labor. She delivers her surplus to the husband. In our culture, it goes with love, honor, and obey. Or what is it? Love, honor, and cherish, or whatever the words are in the marriage seminar. By the way, the marriage ceremony, if you study it, comes directly out of feudalism. In feudalism, when one person becomes the serf of another, you get down on one knee, you get tapped on the shoulder with a sword, and you swear to love, honor, and obey your lord, who swears in turn to do that for you. And so it's a wonderful ceremony. It just has the peculiar quality that the love, honor, and obey that you each say to the other has the effect that one person's producing surplus for the other, not vice versa. Ditto modern marriage. Same arrangement in the traditional form. So do we have a feudal class structure? You betcha. Your husband doesn't pay you wages, at least it's unusual. And he can't buy and sell you? Not quite. So we have feudalism. We have capitalism. We have slavery. We have ancient. Now the communist, all over the place. All over the place. I'll give you two examples. The one that I use a lot, some of you have heard me do it, is from Silicon Valley, the part of our country where we have fancy software engineers. Every year, for 50 years it's been going on, every year dozens, sometimes hundreds of these engineers quit their jobs. They stop working for IBM, they stop working for Cisco Systems, whatever it is, and 10 of them, 20 of them, 40 of them take their laptops and gather in somebody's garage. Instead of getting dressed up in their suits and ties and going to work in the usual manner, they don't have to anymore. They quit their jobs, high-paying jobs, $400,000 a year jobs. They quit them. Now they can come to work in sweatpants, in Hawaiian shirts, high as a kite with frisbees and dogs. And they come to work Monday through Thursday, and they make software the way they always did on their laptops. Friday, they all gather at the worksite, the garage. They don't bring their laptops. They don't bring their dogs. They still bring their cigarettes, because that's life. And here's what they do. All day Friday, they sit around, and they decide what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. In effect, they function as their own board of directors. But from a Marxian perspective, here's the interesting thing. They have organized their workplace so that the surplus they produce, the quantity of software product, is worth more than what they themselves use to sustain their own standard of living. They produce a surplus, but on Friday, they get it and they distribute it. They have set up a communist class structure. By the way, in surveys, most of these California engineers are and are proud to be Republicans. This arrangement in which they have broken, walked with their feet, they voted against capitalism, They argue, when I worked at that big capitalist enterprise, they don't use this language, I was unproductive, I was unhappy, I didn't do very well, I hated my wife, blah, 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 blah. Now, I'm so happy. I'm much more productive. I work together with people. Everybody is equal here. We have no board of directors and underlings, no supervisor, none of that. We work, we monitor ourselves. They love Marx's idea of a communist enterprise. That's what they've arranged. They're Republicans. By the way, when people change their class structure, they may be conscious of doing that or not. For them to be conscious of what they're doing, they would have had to have, for example, this course. They have not, unfortunately, not yet had that pleasure. So they have to use other language. They have other consciousness. So, for example, in Silicon Valley, if you talk to people who have done this, they will tell you about how proud they are of their, here we go now, innovative entrepreneurialism. Whoa. Who cares? Let them call it green bananas. In Marxian theory, those people have made a revolution overthrowing capitalism and substituting a communist class structure, in Marx's sense. And here's a little implication of this. Imagine a left in America which was able to say to the American people, our idea of reorganizing society to give it a better chance of liberty, equality, and fraternity can point to a concrete example here in the United States of workers who've done that. And look, many of these enterprises, by the way, have been going for 50 years. They are successful. They do what they set out to do. And by the way, they're not the only examples. There are others doing that exact same thing, calling it a whole variety of things. But you shouldn't be surprised that they don't call it by its Marxian name, because Marxian theory is a repressed discourse in the United States. It's not taught in most universities. It's not part of the public language. It's not in the mass media. So, of course, they don't have the vocabulary to talk about. It's like going back 100 years and asking if people had vocabulary to talk about anxieties and fears that they feel. No. We now have words like phobia and depression and all the other apparatus of self-awareness psychologically, but it took 100 years to develop that capacity to think like that. And Marxism has to develop comparably in order to give people the social vocabulary to deal with it. And that's what Marxian class analysis does. So what differentiates the United States today from what it was 50 years ago, or today differentiates it from Saudi Arabia or Brazil or China, is not the presence or absence of any of these five. They're all present in all countries most of the time. What differentiates them are the relative importance. There are parts of the world where there's a lot more slavery relative to the total population than there is here. There are parts of the world in which the feudal class structure of the traditional family has almost vanished. Whereas in other parts of the world, it's the dominant class structure of the family, and so on. How a society functions depends on which class structures are dominant in people's lives. Not only in their lives on the job in the workplace, but at home. We're going to have occasion in this next several sessions to talk in detail about this. I can't do that now. But we're going to talk about, for example, that Marxian class analysis allows something you perhaps haven't thought of before. If there are multiple class structures in society, then an individual, you, me, him, her, may very well participate in more than one. So that unlike other theories, like the property theory, you're either in the class of the rich or you're not. You're in one or the other. And many of you may think that class analysis requires figuring out where everybody is. For example, in Russia and China, at certain points, they had people pegged. This is a bourgeois. This is a proletariat. You were one or the other. But not in what I've just told you. It's not part of this. Let me give you an example. At home, if you're a man in a traditional family, you are exploiting your wife. She produces a surplus, she does, that you get and distribute. Then you go to your job where someone exploits you. You're operating in two different class structures, one at home and one on the job. This may do a number on your head. It may be very important, for example, to compensate yourself for the indignities of being exploited on the job by sticking it to your serf at home. Uh-oh. What happens then? How does that work? Here's another possibility. Suppose the conditions of exploitation in the home produce, for all kinds of possible reasons, a welling up of women in traditional households who can't stand being exploited anymore. How surprising is that? How different is it from workers who can't stand being exploited on the job? And if those women refuse, and if that takes the form of, I won't have it anymore, I want a different relationship here, I'm not happy, I'm not satisfied, then we have the question, as in a society, what is the exploiter going to do with the rebellion of the exploited? Come to a compromise. That's one option. Repress. It's another option. Dissolve the relationship. Close the factory. Get a divorce. But if you get a divorce because you can't stand it, but you didn't have an analysis that the class structure of the household was part of your problem, then you take the terrible risk that you identify the problem with that husband and you leave him and you go find another and you do it all again because you haven't understood that it wasn't him and his peculiarities, or at least not only that. It's also a situation you can't stand, but you need an analysis that would help you see that. And Americans, the idea that class exists in the household is a new idea. But it shouldn't be, because Marx said wherever work is done, the question has to be asked, the Marxist class question. Is there surplus being produced by anybody? And if so, by whom? And if so, who gets the surplus? You have to ask that question. And in a household, labor is done. Production occurs all the time. Child care, cooking meals, cleaning things, repairing things, healing people's wounds, etc., all kinds of work. And if work is done, you have to ask the class question. Is there a surplus being produced? Of course you ask that question. So the implications here are stunning. Now let me end, in the time that remains, by giving you some sense of how and why a class analysis based on the analysis of the surplus and how it's organized in society will lead you to have, as we're going to see in the remainder of this session of classes, different analytical results. And I'm going to pick some examples which we're going to go into in detail. So I hope to tease you and entice you and get you interested, because we're going to do it in detail. So I'm going to give you some with heavy political implications. So let me pick one. The Soviet Union. And I'm going to give you now a stylized version. We're going to do this in detail later. A stylized version. In 1917, a revolt. A revolt of the masses of peasants and workers against hundreds of years of dynastic absolute monarchy. The Tsars, they were called in Russia. And this one, the Tsar is overthrown, the Tsar is killed, and his family is, it's very dramatic, a revolution that overthrows Tsarist Russia and establishes the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Goes from monarchy to republic, from capitalist and feudal to social. Wow! And what do they do? Well, they're Marxists. The leaders of this revolution are Marxists. Stalin, Trotsky, Lenin, and all the others are Marxists, steeped in Marxism. Trotsky and Lenin are fantastic writers, major contributors to the Marxist theoretical tradition. So these are Marxists, sophisticated students. They have, however, taken Marx's work and by the way, I don't mean to be a Monday morning quarterback. If I had been them living in their circumstances, I would do exactly what I'm about to describe. But I don't. So I don't think the way they do. Heaven, that's a good thing. It'd be very strange if I did. Coming here at a different time, a different place, and so forth. So here's what they did. They saw Marx as a more radical version of the old thinkers in class terms who were concerned about property and power. So what they did is they wanted to overthrow capitalism to radically change the distribution of property and to radically change the distribution of power and to radically change people's consciousness from being a serf or a lord. The old Russian self-identification consciousness, we became all workers and peasants. That's a radical change of how you think of yourself. What did they do to property? Very impressive. They took the property away from the rich, basically. They took it away from the capitalists, and they made it the property of everybody. In the case of industry, it became nationalized or socialized property, and everybody had an equal share. Radical change in the distribution of property. On the countryside, they did something different. For those of you who don't know, you'll learn about that. They took the land away from the bigger landowners, but they gave everybody private property and land. By the way, the notion that the Soviet Union abolished private property is something that can only be said by a person who has no idea what happened. I mean, it's really painful. It's a little bit like you're telling me that Rush Limbaugh is a leader of the American Socialist Movement. If you say that, I would be upset because it shows you are so far out of it, I wouldn't even know how to begin to talk to you. To tell me that the Soviet Union is the end of private property is a level of ignorance that's painful. I'm embarrassed for you. It's like you forgot your pants today, and here you are in our little group, standing there with nothing, and it's embarrassing. And you're going to notice it in a few minutes, and I can see how it's going to hurt your feelings, and you're going to run off and all the rest. So they gave the land to all the little peasants. That's an equal distribution of property to each peasant. Did power change? Are you kidding? The court of the Tsar is gone. The power of the Russian Orthodox Church, which was enormous, decimated. Power is distributed to Soviets, little groups of workers and peasants, all over. A dramatic Marxist change in the distribution of property, in the distribution of power, in the consciousness of the people. Dramatic Marxist change. What did they do to the organization of surplus? I'm going to exaggerate, but not by much. Nothing. What do I mean? The day before the revolution, the workers came at 8 o'clock and they stayed until 5. At the end of the day, they left behind what they worked in a Moscow or Leningrad factory. They were paid a wage. They produced more than the wage, the same way my $30 of pens and the $20. And a board of directors of the capitalist corporation that employed them got the difference, got the surplus and distributed. The day after the revolution, they came to work, they did exactly the same thing. They produced a surplus, they didn't get it. Who got it? A group of government officials called commissars, commissioners, Russian word for commissioner, commissar. The state took over, the state took the surplus, and the state distributed it. The workers were no longer exploited by the private owners of the means of production. They were now exploited by the state, the workers' state, the Bolshevik workers' state. Because they're evil? No, no, no. They didn't think in terms of changing the organization of the surplus. They had assimilated Marx's new idea back into the older, much more well-known notions of class about power, property, and consciousness. So they changed what they thought was the class structure, leaving in place the old one. And as the Soviet Union struggled, it never dealt with that problem. And eventually, the conflicts, the bitterness, and the tensions between the mass of exploited workers and the now government exploiters led to an explosion in which they got rid of the public governmental exploitative apparatus and reestablished a private capitalist system of exploitation, to which one can only hang one's head in horrible empathy with the Russian people. Oh my God, the tragedy double. And why? Again, to drive the point home, because the analytical framework to follow Marx's argument that you have to change the organization of surplus, that wasn't attended to. It's not because the government forced it on anybody. The mass of people didn't think that way either. They thought they had made the revolution when they changed property, power, and consciousness. What would it have meant in the Soviet Union to deal with class in the Marxian sense? You would have had to dramatically alter how production was organized in the factory, in the office, and in the household. Because if you only change the class structure in the workplace, but you leave an exploitative class structure in the household, what will that do? For example, what does it mean that children are raised in a household where the husband exploits the wife? Nobody says that. Nobody's conscious of that. We love each other. Sure you do. Just the way thousands of masters loved their slaves and thousands of lords did, genuinely. They didn't see a problem in the coexistence of a love relationship and an exploitative one. And by the way, those two can exist together, heaven knows, but they can also clash. But the clash will not appear to be that if you don't have the ability to see the issue of the organization of the surplus. In the Soviet Union, it was the end of that system. It could not deal with that issue, and that had something to do with its history. Just like an inability to do this kind of analysis will also make it very difficult, for example, to understand, I will argue later, indeed next week when we meet, it'll be very difficult to understand the current global capitalist crisis. You're going to see, as we do this next week, how I will use the Marxist analysis of surplus to give you a consistent explanation for how and why global capitalism, led by the United States, ended up in the collapse of the last 3 years. Why did we go from 7 million, the official number of unemployed in December of 2007 in the United States, to 16 million today? A number of unemployed that has risen without interruption to this moment right now. What is that about? That has to do with the relationship between the producers and appropriators and distributors of the surplus. I'll show you that. And it's not because I figured something out. I just used that framework to analyze the situation. And I'm going to show you the analysis that results from it. And I think you'll find it very persuasive. And you'll certainly find it interesting enough that you'll be kind of pissed that you hadn't already encountered this. That among the other explanations having to do with such profound insights as people were greedy or people were dishonest. Or people didn't properly supervise. We didn't have the right regulation. Deep analysis, this is not. So I think I'll show you that even if you're not persuaded by what I do, you'll see there's a remarkable way to explain and analyze not only the crisis as it emerges, but the crisis as it plays itself out now and the extraordinary absence of a government program to deal with this. So I think you will be able to see that in the case of the Soviet Union, which we will return to, in the case of the crisis of the United States, which we will deal with next week, that Marxian class analysis is an immense, complex, sophisticated, rich way of understanding the society, and that there is something verging on the criminal, that you haven't been introduced to it, that it hasn't been presented to you, that you haven't been taught it enough that you can use it, and then make up your own mind whether the analytical understandings you get are satisfactory or not, the way you would with another theory. You live in a society which is afraid of doing that. And not the least importance of an institution like the Brecht Forum is that it wants to offset, correct, and remedy that defect in this culture. I personally think you will also get from Marxian class analysis a way to begin to understand not only why the events of your life are happening, and I mean that in your personal life as well as your larger citizenship roles, but I think you will get major help in beginning to answer the question, what can I do about it? Do I only have to be a passive observer of all of this, or are there ways that people who see these things can begin to intervene and make the history change from what it otherwise would have been? And if I could conclude, I would say, if you're self-conscious, then informing yourself and learning about Marxian class analysis is a necessary step to having an adult developed framework for being a productive citizen of this culture. It is not a virtue of this culture of the United States, and I've spent all my adult life in the American university system, that's what I do. It is not a virtue that this is unknown. It is a sign of immaturity, fear, and hysteria that this elaborated system, with so much to offer, is unavailable for the vast majority of people. So California Republican communists will remain unaware of what they have done, unaware of its implications. That's bad enough. But the American left, which ought to build off of those experiments and teach what they imply, that those people walked away from capitalism because it was unsatisfactory and unhappy and made them unproductive, so they could go to a communist enterprise where they are much happier and much more productive. Little clue. Many of the most important technical breakthroughs of modern telecommunications and computers were achieved in these little communal enterprises. They are testimony to the productivity of the communist organization of production. But they are regularly trumpeted all over the world as great fruits of modern American capitalism. What a hustle.
And that was the first part of Richard Wolff's course on Marxian economics and class consciousness. We're now going to conclude the show with a few minutes of the last chapter of David Graeber's Debt, the First 5,000 Years. We're going to pick up just before we left off last week. This is the part in which David Graeber is characterizing the vast machine to perpetuate hopelessness, which gave us the title for this week's show. Financiers were bailed out with taxpayer money, which basically means that their imaginary money was treated as if it were real. Mortgage holders were overwhelmingly left to the tender mercies of the courts under a bankruptcy law that Congress had, a year before, rather suspiciously presciently, one might add, made far more exacting against debtors. Nothing was altered. All major decisions were postponed. The great conversation that many were expecting never happened. We live now at a genuinely peculiar historical juncture. The credit crisis has provided us with a vivid illustration of the principle set out in the last chapter, that capitalism cannot really operate in a world where people believe it will be around forever. For most of the last several centuries, most people assumed that credit could not be generated infinitely because they assumed that the economic system itself was unlikely to endure forever. The future was likely to be fundamentally different. Yet, somehow, the anticipated revolutions never happened. The basic structures of financial capitalism largely remained in place. It's only now, at the very moment when it's becoming increasingly clear that current arrangements are not viable, that we've suddenly hit the wall in terms of our collective imagination. There is very good reason to believe that in a generation or so, capitalism itself will no longer exist. Most obviously, as ecologists keep reminding us, because it's impossible to maintain an engine of perpetual growth forever on a finite planet. And the current form of capitalism doesn't seem to be capable of generating the kind of vast technological breakthroughs and mobilizations that would be required for us to start finding and colonizing other planets. Yet, faced with the prospect of capitalism actually ending, the most common reaction, even from those who call themselves progressives, is simply fear. We cling to what exists because we can no longer imagine an alternative that wouldn't be even worse. How did we get here? My own suspicion is that we're looking at the final effects of the militarization of American capitalism itself. In fact, it could well be said that the last 30 years have seen the construction of a vast bureaucratic apparatus for the creation and maintenance of hopelessness, a giant machine designed first and foremost to destroy any sense of possible alternative futures. At its root is a veritable obsession on the part of the rulers of the world in response to the upheavals of the 60s and 70s with ensuring that social movements cannot be seen to grow, flourish, or propose alternatives, that those who challenge existing power arrangements can never, under any circumstances, be perceived to win. To do so requires creating a vast apparatus of armies, prisons, police, various forms of private security firms, and police and military intelligence apparatus, and propaganda engines of every conceivable variety, most of which do not attack alternatives directly, so much as create a pervasive climate of fear, jingoistic conformity, and simple despair that renders any thought of changing the world seem an idle fantasy. Maintaining this apparatus seems even more important to exponents of the free market, even than maintaining any sort of viable market economy. How else can one explain what happened in the former Soviet Union? One would ordinarily have imagined that the end of the Cold War would have led to the dismantling of the army and the KGB and the rebuilding of factories. But in fact, what happened was precisely the other way round. This is just an extreme example of what has been happening everywhere. Economically, the apparatus is pure deadweight. All the guns, surveillance cameras, and propaganda engines are extraordinarily expensive and really produce nothing. And no doubt, it's yet another element dragging the entire capitalist system down, along with producing the illusion of an endless capitalist future that laid the groundwork for the endless bubbles to begin with. Finance capital became the buying and selling of chunks of that future, and economic freedom, for most of us, was reduced to the right to buy and sell a small piece of one's permanent subordination. In other words, there seems to have been a profound contradiction between the political imperative of establishing capitalism as the only possible way to manage anything and capitalism's own unacknowledged need to limit its future horizons lest speculation, predictably, go haywire. Once it did, and the whole machine imploded, we were left in a strange situation of not being able to even imagine any other way that things might be arranged. About the only thing we can imagine is catastrophe. To begin to free ourselves, the first thing we need to do is to see ourselves again as historical actors, as people who can make a difference in the course of world events. And this is exactly what the militarization of history is trying to take away.
And of course, this is exactly what David Graeber is trying to give us, which, combined with his scholarship, is what makes it such a tremendous book. Now, if you're a regular listener to the show, I don't suspect you will be in any doubt as to whether you can make a difference. But if you are, contact the people that you love and let them know that you love them. That's the difference. I think the mass media has people enthralled. It focuses our attention on what it chooses to focus, the national, the international, the large scale, and in so doing often disempowers us from making a change at the local level, from being aware of changes that others are making. So, not only does David Graeber pointing a finger at the military-industrial complex, no, it's not defending us from anything, it's not needed, it's a dead weight, it's actually exhausting the resources available to it in a desperate attempt to perpetuate itself, to maintain the illusion that things have to be this way. Most of the people I meet are pretty convinced that things not only don't have to be this way, they couldn't possibly stay this way for much longer anyway. So if you'd like to download this show or previous shows, you can do so from our website at unwelcomeguests.net, where you can also leave feedback about the shows. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening, and keep giving all you can.